Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I did do something the Hemingway tonight, half an hour ago. I launched a Kickstarter campaign, which crowdfunding is not something that I'm really, comfortable with. But the thing I like about Kickstarter is you figure out, what's the minimum amount of money to sort of go ahead with this project. It's not like how much would I expect to make from doing this project. It's like what's the minimum amount to sort of mitigate the risk of doing the work. If no one ends up buying this product at the end of the day, then how much would you need to earn back just so that you haven't completely ruined your own life, essentially? Because what I'm talking about is the project translating the entire book of War and Peace into Bogan Australian. I crunched the numbers. It would take me, there's 365 chapters of War and Peace, which makes it easy to crunch numbers because you can go, okay, so if I was going to do it one chapter per day, that would take exactly 1 year to do. And on average, how long would it take me to translate one chapter? I estimated, I think it would actually take longer than this, but I did the math using the figure 2 hours per day, 2 hours per chapter to do the translation. I reckon you'd probably end up spending a few more hours than that. But I kind of wanted to go minimum. Like I said, it's not covering the entire cost of doing the project. It's more like mitigating the risk. Anyway, so I crunched the numbers, I came up with a figure, and the cool thing about Kickstarter is you set the campaign goal. This is how much I need to go ahead. And then you start gathering pledges, right? So you pledge an amount of money that you want to support, you want to back the project. Now, it's not a donation, it's more like a pre-order. And you pre-order, and for being a pre-orderer and backing the project, you get extra perks like maybe a limited edition of the book or some behind-the-scenes access to the daily goings-on of translating the book or a ticket to the book launch party, or there's other kind of special one-of-a-kind rewards that you can get. Well, I shouldn't say one-of-a-kind. Limited edition, I should say. Right, so you're not donating, you're sort of backing it, but you get rewards. But if it doesn't gather enough, then those backings don't get taken, right? So you've got a set amount of days to raise the money. But if you don't hit that goal, then none of the money gets taken, right? So if you back the project, you only end up making the purchase if the campaign is successful. I like that because it's I wouldn't want to raise half of the amount of money that I need to go ahead, and then all that money gets delivered to me, and then I've kind of got to fulfill this project, but at my own risk, my own expense, and I'd only be doing it, I'd still have to go out and earn money, so I wouldn't have the time to do work on the project, all the rest, so the project would suffer, and I don't like that. There's other crowdfunding places where it does that. If you don't reach the target, the campaign is still considered successful anyway, and all the money gets delivered, and the project goes ahead. And it's if you've got a project budget and you haven't met it, how are you supposed to go ahead with the project? Doesn't really make sense to me. Anyway, what am I talking about? I'm making this sound very dull. It's actually quite exciting. So for the last 16 days, I've been dabbling over at the A Year of War and Peace subreddit, right? And I haven't been reading along with those guys, but I've been doing something else. I've been translating the opening paragraph of each chapter into Bogan Australian. And those guys have really been getting a kick out of it. I've been getting a lot of comments, people saying, this is, my favorite thing about this whole project is reading your daily translations, or just people saying they find them funny, and they're getting a lot of upvotes. And someone said, you could make a killing translating this book. So it started to make me think, people would actually read, people would actually purchase a Bogan translation of War and Peace. And they also seem to be quite excited just about the concept of it. So I said, what the hell? you kind of got to suck it and see, don't you? So I made the campaign. I just launched it. And we have 43 days to see if we can hit the project goal. Right. Interesting thing. Go to Kickstarter.com if you want to back it. And just, I guess you could just search for Bogan, B-O-G-A-N, War and Peace. Bogan War and Peace. You should find it pretty easily. I doubt whether there's any other projects that are a Bogan War and Peace. Or I'll put a link to it in the description of this podcast episode if you want to have a look what rewards I'm offering and read the campaign description. And I don't know, it's quite exciting. I don't sound excited for two reasons. Firstly, it's 1:30 a.m. in the morning and I'm pretty tired. And the other reason is, like, I'm really excited about the project, but the thing that kind of, like, I don't like the money side of it, and like trying to figure out a budget and figure out like how much to charge for different rewards, and I don't know, that just makes me feel kind of strange. So I'm glad all that's behind me. It's set. The campaign is live. We've got 43 days to see if we match the target. If we do not meet the target, then that's it. We put the idea behind us and say, huh, well, could have been great, but we didn't quite get there. So, I am excited. I just don't sound it because of those things. Anyway, we are here today to discuss Chapter 7 of The Blue Hotel and to read Chapter 8. Is that correct? Yeah. Yeah, that's where we're up to. The questions that I asked the Reddit community about Chapter 7 were, do you think we've seen the last of the Swede? Do you consider the Swede the antagonist of this story? Antagonist means the bad guy. And number three, if this story were an allegory, what would its hidden meaning? Oh, I wrote that wrong. What would its hidden meaning be? Is what I meant to ask. JMama8779 said, in general, my whole theory has gone pretty far out the window. Now I'm just as confused as the characters going through it. Laura Y. Stitch said, I'm worried that it's going to end and I'll still be confused. JMama8779 said, I'm with you. That is a worry now that you say that, but I just don't think it'll happen. I'm sure, I've just got faith in Stephen Crane by now that I'm sure he'll wrap it up. Like, The Open Boat was so satisfying for a short story as well. Short stories so often just kind of like leave you hanging, or they make you think, as the author would say. Like, it's supposed to make you think, and it's like that's just a cop out for giving an unsatisfying ending. But The Open Boat really, really ended nicely, so I have faith in our friend Stephen Graham. Techrific said, we can't grasp a character from the outside. In a sense, we have to understand them, recognize their humanity. But I'm having a hard time with the Swede. Crane is balancing this on a razor's edge. Still, the Swede is intriguing enough to keep my interest up and to wonder about what could be wrong with him. What has he suffered to be this way? The Swede could be the protagonist of this story, as user Swim Said the Mama Fishy also suggests. But he could just as easily be the antagonist. It's all a matter of perspective, which I think Crane is playing around with here, just as he did in The Open Boat with the crazy folks on the beach. Granted, the Swede seems crazy however which way you slice it, but could there be a reasonable explanation that made him behave in this way? Can we think of any justification for his unstable conduct towards everybody? Things may not be exactly how they appear to be. If we were inside the head of the Swede, things might look very different to us. An old adage goes something like this, if you can't find the arsehole in the room, it's you. From the perspective of the majority of the characters, and from the reader's perspective, the Swede is the arsehole in the room, no question. So the intention of the author, at least for now, is to indicate that the Swede is the antagonist at this point. But maybe that could change, maybe that's the point of the story. In any case, it's too early to tell, I think. I don't think we've seen the last of the Swede, and quite frankly, I fear for him when we do. This can't end well. It's a really good comparison, Tekrific, between that scene in the open boat where there were the people on the beach waving the jacket above their head, trying to signal something to the people on the boat. But to us, who the readers who were people on the boat, you know, we were put in the position of the people on the boat. We were just left wondering, what the heck is wrong with those people on the beach just standing there screaming and waving that jacket above their heads? Like, they were fools to us. Surely if we were on the other side of the story, over on the beach with those folks, there would be a reasonable explanation. It's just so, I don't know, like, what could be the reasonable explanation for the Swede's actions? Did he miss his meds or something? Like, what's going on with this guy? He seems a bit out of his mind. That old adage as well, if you can't find the asshole in the room, it's you. Makes me worried. I'm always worried, what if I'm... Am I the asshole? Maybe I am. Damn. You give me a complex. It also reminds me of that really funny sketch, that David Mitchell sketch, where they're like the Nazis, but they don't realize they're bad guys, and then he has that epiphany where he's like, are we the baddies? It's really funny. Anyway, Al Virk said, I'm loving Stephen Crane's work thus far. He's got a nice way of keeping you guessing what's going to happen up until the very end. I'm excited for the end of this story, but I have no idea what's in store. He does do that really well, doesn't he? He balances this fine line between, like, not having any idea what's going on, but still giving you that sense that it's attainable, right? Something is going on. It's not just nonsense. There is a reasonable explanation for it all, but you just can't for the life of you figure it out. He is brilliant when it comes to that. There's a real sense of, like, surrealness in his stories, but at the same time, they're believable, right? They feel realistic, but yeah, I don't know, it's a strange mix. Very nicely done. Swim said the mum of fishy said, I think Scully is the antagonist. He's the one who brings them to the hotel, forces the Swede to stay, and arranges the details of the fight. We haven't seen the last of the Swede. I think he's the protagonist. Interesting, Scully as the antagonist. I think Scully is a poor leader. He's definitely in the leadership role in this story. I don't know what it is with me. I'm always trying to put my finger on, like, who is the leader in a situation. Like, all situations have this, like, assigned leader. But I think on some level, you know, very rarely is it a formally assigned leader. But on some subconscious level, there always sort of is a bit of a prescribed leader in any group, right? It just kind of naturally happens. And then it's a question of whether or not their leadership is warranted. And for this case, I think Scully owns the hotel, so he has the final say. He's the patriarch in this situation, but he's a poor leader. He's making bad decisions. He's making bad calls. He seems kind of impatient as well. His decision making seems kind of rash in a lot of cases. Like, first of all, everyone was trying to tell him that the Swede was acting irrationally at the start, when he first kind of entered the scene. And he kind of didn't take their word for it. He blamed them, and he took the Swede off and gave him the alcohol and all the rest. But he was making decisions rashly. He wasn't figuring the situation out. He wasn't taking the time to really listen to everyone. He was just acting. And then later on, the Swede finally got on his nerves, and he just sort of impatiently went, yep, go ahead and have a fight. And almost like he couldn't be bothered dealing with it anymore, he made his own son have this fist fight with a stranger. So, we didn't make him, but he allowed it to happen. He gave it the okay. So, I don't know. I think I never thought of him as the antagonist until now, Swim said to Mama Fishy, but now that you say it, yeah, in a way I can see it. Swim said the Mama Fishy also said, interesting choice of the word gay. I knew its meaning had changed, so I looked up its etymology to see what it would have meant to these characters. As per Wikipedia, by the late 17th century, it had acquired the very specific meaning of addicted to pleasures and dissipations, an extension of its primary meaning of carefree, implying uninhibited by moral constraints. What seems on the surface a fairly innocuous word, the cowboy's use of the word gay could have been a provocation in 1895. Coming up empty in the allegorical department, although the last line is reminiscent of a Greek chorus. Yeah, the allegory question. I was hoping someone would have an answer to that. Well, I'm going to read the rest of the comments and see if anyone has an answer to that, and then I'll circle back around to it. 14843759283 said, that's an interesting perspective. Although I don't know if I would call the Swede the protagonist, considering his questionable behaviour and actions, and the fact that we don't ever really get his particular perspective or thoughts on the circumstances. I would lean more towards saying that there isn't a protagonist, in the usual sense. But rather, the story shows an unusual example of the conflict between people and their emotions. That would make more sense, given the way we see the Swede act so strange because of his irrational fears of what the others will do to him. The way we see Johnny act so violent towards the Swede just because he was accused of cheating, and the way we are now seeing Scully and the cowboy convince themselves of the need to attack the Swede because they don't like his behaviour and attitude so far. I'm not sure, however. I do really hope, but I kind of doubt, but I hope that we will get to see the, like, get to understand the Swede's point of view in some way. I think if we found out what was in his bag, right, we might understand his behavior. I don't know why, I just think that's the key to it. But I've also just got this feeling that we just won't. Like, that from here on, it'll just be the rest of the guys, Johnny, Scully, cowboy, trying to like piece it all together. Maybe, I don't know. I hope we find out. Wasm said, I think if we followed the Swede from the beginning and got to know him a bit, I imagine we would be way more understanding, maybe even forgiving, of his behavior. I was thinking the Swede may leave, but not this soon. We still have a couple of chapters left. I was thinking either the two men run out after the Swede, or we follow the Swede into town. Then the story could shift between the hotel and the Swede, or focus exclusively on the Swede. Well, that would be cool. You know what I reckon will happen is he'll come back. Like, he'll burst back into the hotel and make another scene or something like that. I don't know. Let's find out. Let's keep reading, eh? First, I was going to circle back around to that allegory question. What is the allegory? What is the metaphor hidden in this story? I don't really have an answer. It just has that vague feeling like it would have some kind of hidden deeper meaning. By now, Stephen Crane's work just kind of feels that way to me as well. The only thing I can think of is the phenomena of the self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, the Swede started carrying on about, well, being killed, but essentially about, like, violence. He was sure violence was coming his way. And, of course, his own fuss was what brought the violence his way. That he was acting so, well, rudely, I suppose, to everyone else. Ended up getting him into a fight. He had this expectation that the town he was in and the hotel that he was in was going to be a violent place, and it was his own expectation that brought that circumstance to be, right? So it's that self-fulfilling prophecy type allegory, which the self-fulfilling prophecy, like self-talk or whatever you call it, does factor in very strongly with any mental health stories, I think. That belief in something can bring it about when it comes to your own mental health. Like, if you start believing you're going crazy, then you will start to feel crazy. Something like that. I don't know, it's an ill-conceived notion that I'm trying to portray to you here, but that was what I was thinking. Really, I asked that question because I was hoping that someone else might have something really interesting. But alas, maybe I'll ask it again after today's chapter and see what we get. Alright, let's move forward, shall we? Let's go to The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane, Chapter 8. Oh, pleasant surprise for the first two words. Chapter 8. The Swede, tightly gripping his valise, tacked across the face of the storm as if he carried sails. He was following a line of little naked, gasping trees, which he knew must mark the way of the road. His face, fresh from the pounding of Johnny's fists, felt more pleasure than pain in the wind and the driving snow. A number of square shapes loomed upon him, finally, and he knew them as houses of the main body of the town. He found a street and made travel along it, leaning heavily upon the wind whenever, at a corner, a terrific blast caught him. He might have been in a deserted village. We picture the world as thick with conquering and elate humanity, but here, with the bugles of the tempest pealing, it was hard to imagine a peopled earth. One viewed the existence of man, then, as a marvel, and conceded a glamour of wonder to these lice which were caused to cling to a whirling, fire-smote, ice-locked, disease-stricken, space-lost bulb. The conceit of man was explained by this storm to be the very engine of life. One was a coxcomb not to die in it. However, the Swede found a saloon. In front of it, an indomitable red light was burning, and the snowflakes were made blood colour as they flew through the circumscribed territory of the lamps shining. The Swede pushed open the door of the saloon and entered. A sanded expanse was before him, and at the end of it, four men sat at a table drinking. Down one side of the room extended a radiant bar, and its guardian was leaning upon his elbows, listening to the talk of the men at the table. The Swede dropped his valise upon the floor, and smiling fraternally upon the barkeeper, said, "Give me some whiskey, will you?" The man placed a bottle, a whiskey glass, and a glass of thick ice water upon the bar. The Swede poured himself an abnormal portion of whiskey and drank it in three gulps. "Pretty bad night," remarked the bartender indifferently. He was making the pretension of blindness, which is usually a distinction of his class, but it could have been seen that he was furtively studying the half-erased bloodstains on the face of the Swede. "Bad night," he said again. "Oh, it's good enough for me," replied the Swede, heartily, as he poured himself some more whiskey. The barkeeper took his coin and manoeuvred it through its reception by the highly nickeled cash machine. A bell rang. A card labelled 20 cents had appeared. "No," continued the Swede, "this isn't too bad weather. It's good enough for me." "So," murmured the barkeeper languidly. The copious drams made the Swede's eyes swim, and he breathed a trifle heavier. "Yes, I like this weather. I like it. It suits me." It was apparently his design to impart a deep significance to these words. "So?" murmured the bartender again. He turned to gaze dreamily at the scroll-like birds and bird-like scrolls, which had been drawn with soap upon the mirrors back of the bar. "Well, I guess I'll take another drink," said the Swede presently. "Have something?" "No, thanks, I'm not drinking," answered the bartender. Afterwards he asked, "How did you hurt your face?" The Swede immediately began to boast loudly. "Why, in a fight, I thumped the soul out of a man down here at Scully's Hotel." The interest of the four men at the table was at last aroused. "Who was it?" said one. "Johnny Scully," blustered the Swede. Son of the man, what runs it? He will be pretty near dead for some weeks, I can tell you. I made a nice thing of him, I did. He couldn't get up. They carried him in the house. Have a drink. Instantly the men in some subtle way encased themselves in reserve. No thanks, said one. The group was of curious formation. Two were prominent local businessmen, one was the district attorney, and one was a professional gambler of the kind known as Square. But a scrutiny of the group would not have enabled an observer to pick the gambler from the men of more reputable pursuits. He was, in fact, a man so delicate in manner, when among people of fair class, and so judicious in his choice of victims, that in the strict masculine part of the town's life, he had come to be explicitly trusted and admired. People called him a thoroughbred. The fear and contempt with which his craft was regarded was undoubtedly the reason that his quiet dignity shone conspicuous above the quiet dignity of the men who might be merely hatters, billiard markers, or grocery clerks. Beyond an occasional unwary traveller who came by rail, this gambler was supposed to prey solely upon reckless and senile farmers who, when flush with good crops, drove into town in all the pride and confidence of an absolutely invulnerable stupidity. Hearing at times in circuitous fashion of the despoilment of such a farmer, the important men of Romper invariably laughed in contempt of the victim, and if they thought of the wolf at all, it was with a kind of pride at the knowledge that he would never dare think of attacking their wisdom and courage. Besides, it was popular that this gambler had a real wife and two real children in a neat cottage in the suburb, where he led an exemplary home life, and when anyone even suggested a discrepancy in his character, the crowd immediately vociferated descriptions of his virtuous family circle. Then, men who led exemplary home lives and men who did not lead exemplary home lives all subsided in a bunch, remarking that there was nothing more to be said. However, when a restriction was placed upon him, as, for instance, when a strong clique of members of the new Pollywog Club refused to permit him, even as a spectator, to appear in the rooms of the organization, the candor and gentleness with which he accepted the judgment disarmed many of his foes and made his friends more desperately partisan. He invariably distinguished between himself and a respectable romper man so quickly and frankly that his manner actually appeared to be a continual broadcast compliment. And one must not forget to declare the fundamental fact of his entire position in Romper. It is irrefutable that in all affairs outside of his business, in all matters that occur eternally and commonly between man and man, this thieving card player was so generous, so just, so moral that, in a contest, he could have put to flight the consciences of 9/10 of the citizens of Romper. And so it happened that he was seated in this saloon with the two prominent local merchants and the district attorney. The Swede continued to drink raw whiskey, meanwhile babbling at the barkeeper and trying to induce him to indulge in potations. Come on, have a drink, come on. What, no? Well, have a little one, then. By God, I've whipped a man tonight, and I want to celebrate. I whipped him good, too, gentlemen, the Swede cried to the men at the table. Have a drink. "Shh," said the barkeeper. The group at the table, although furtively attentive, had been pretending to be in deep talk, but now a man lifted his eyes towards the Swede and said shortly, "Thanks, we don't want any more." And this reply, the Swede ruffled out his chest like a rooster. "Well," he exploded, "it seems I can't get anybody to drink with me in this town. Seems so, don't it? Well." "Shh," said the barkeeper. "Say," snarled the Swede, "don't you try to shut me up. I won't have it. I'm a gentleman, and I want people to drink with me. And I want 'em to drink with me now. Now, do you understand?" He rapped the bar with his knuckles. Years of experience had calloused the bartender. He merely grew sulky. "I hear you," he answered. "Well," cried the Swede, "listen hard then. See those men over there? Well, they're going to drink with me, and don't you forget it. Now you watch." "Hi," yelled the barkeeper, "this won't do." "Why won't it?" demanded the Swede. He stalked over to the table and by chance laid his hand upon the shoulder of the gambler. "How about this?" he asked wrathfully. "I asked you to drink with me." The gambler simply twisted his head and spoke over his shoulder. "My friend, I don't know you." "Oh, hell," answered the Swede. "Come and have a drink." "Now, my boy," advised the gambler kindly, "take your hand off my shoulder and go away and mind your own business." He was a little slim man, and it seemed strange to hear him use this tone of heroic patronage to the burly Swede. The other men at the table said nothing. "What? You won't drink with me, you little dude. I'll make you then. I'll make you." The Swede had grasped the gambler frenziedly at the throat and was dragging him from his chair. The other men sprang up. The barkeeper dashed around the corner of his bar. There was a great tumult, and then was seen a long blade in the hand of the gambler. It shot forward, and a human body, this citadel of virtue, wisdom, power, was pierced as easily as if it had been a melon. The Swede fell with a cry of supreme astonishment. The prominent merchants and the district attorney must have at once tumbled out of the place backward. The bartender found himself hanging limply to the arm of a chair and gazing into the eyes of a murderer. "Henry," said the latter, as he wiped his knife on one of the towels that hung beneath the bar rail, "you tell him where to find me. I'll be home, waiting for him." Then he vanished. A moment afterwards, the barkeeper was in the street, dinning through the storm for help, and moreover, companionship. The corpse of the Swede, alone in the saloon, had its eyes fixed upon a dreadful legend that dwelt atop of the cash machine. "This registers the amount of your purchase." Wow. All right. Another chapter down. That was good. That was awesome. Oh my God. I'm just kind of speechless now. That chapter was so good. That chapter just, I think, immediate reaction, put this book ahead of The Open Boat for me, personally. Up until this chapter, I was thinking, yeah, I like this story. It's a really good story. I think The Open Boat might be my preference. I think I like The Open Boat more. Now, though, damn, like that was awesome. All right, I cannot wait to read what you all have to say about Chapter 8 of the Blue Hotel. Have your say over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I'll leave a few discussion prompts. Oh, man. Yeah, that's really that's kind of stunned me, that chapter. That's so good. Wow. I loved it because we were just saying we want to get inside the head of the Swede to some extent to sort of see things from his point of view. Right? Like, is it a biased thing that everyone in the hotel is kind of against the Swede because they all sort of know each other to some degree, or they sort of all belong together and he's the outsider? So is it biased to make him look crazy? And then we get to see him in a new group, and almost immediately he's kind of shown his true colors a bit. Well, more so. I don't know, man, that was cool. I need to wrap my head around that for a little bit. That one chapter had so many great moments, right? So many good moments in that one chapter. That's one of the questions I'm definitely going to drop into the discussion prompts. Which was your favorite moment from that chapter? I think I know what mine is. I won't say it though. I'll say it in the next episode when we talk about it. That's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.